Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf now. Makes me smile every time it catches my eye. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott. It's my show. The Scott Horton Show here on Liberty Express, 3 to 5 Eastern. You guys are used to hearing Charles Goyette on Alan Butler's show. But we like to talk to our old friend Charles from Anti-War Radio Days every once in a while when we can. Hey, Charles, how's things?
Scott, it's great to talk to you. Things are great.
Good, good. Happy to have you here. Man, does everybody's phone sound terrible, or is it something broken here? I was pretty sure it was everybody else's fault but mine, but now I'm starting to wonder. Anyway.
Well, this phone should sound great.
All right, well, we're gonna see what happens. So, Charles, you wrote some books. One of them is big and yellow and has a melting dollar on the front, and it's really easy to recognize at the Christmas shopping store. It's called The Dollar Meltdown, and it's really good and fun to read. And then also there's another one too, which isn't quite as fun to read because it's even worse about how bad things really are. I mean, it's good on how bad things really are is what I'm trying to say there. So that's red and blue and broke all over, the trouble the American government has got the American country into, or something like that. I forgot the title. Red and blue and broke all over. So everybody ought to go and spend as much money as they can getting the most expensive copy they can from their favorite local bookseller. The Dollar Meltdown and Red and Blue and Broke All Over. And check out Charles' website, charlesgoyette.com. So, I'm glad I got a chance to say that, because I really like those books a lot, and I really do want people to read them, and also to pay you.
Well, that's very generous of you. You're really in the Christmas spirit.
Yeah. So, everyone, obey my commands and follow my influence. All right. Now, so let me ask you this. I saw on the TV yesterday, and they said that the central bank has decided that they've done a great job, and now it's time to go ahead and back off all of their monetary stimulus and all of their, what, 85-something billion dollars a month worth of securities they've been buying, and they're going to start tapering, I mean, slowly backing off the amount of new money that they're inflating. And so I guess you and all the free market guys were proven wrong, and interventionism works great. And we're living the good times right now because of it, because that's what they said on CNN.
Well, I suppose that's one way to put it, and I'm not surprised you would find it put that way in the national news media. This thing has been an absolute debacle. It's been, I don't take any particular delight. To me, it's not personal. I don't take any particular delight in Ben Bernanke leaving the Fed next month, because he's going to be replaced with somebody who, you know, worships at the same temple and has the same, you know, Keynesian spend your way to prosperity, primitive, superstitious beliefs. So, but he has been an absolute calamity, if you think about it. You know, this may get a little technical for people, but when Ben Bernanke came in the door, took the helm of the Federal Reserve, the monetary base, the balance sheet of the Fed, was just a little over $800 billion. That was in 2005. He's walking out the door now. The balance sheet of the Fed as he leaves will be almost eight times as large. Almost, we're talking about $4 trillion. So what happened? Well, the Fed basically created out of thin air during Ben Bernanke's reign, with the monetary base beginning at about $800 billion, it suddenly just spiked. It was a hockey stick curve that went straight up, and it doubled. And it doubled again, and now it's growing again. So it has quintupled during his tenure. And this all represents money that was just made up out of thin air. It was money that was just printed the morning before in the basement of the Mariner Eccles building in Washington, D.C. It's just a few electrons sit spinning around in cyberspace by the keystroke someplace that created trillions of dollars of new U.S. dollars out of nothing. And what did they use the money for? Well, they used the money to buy the downgraded debt of the United States Treasury, and they used the money to buy, you know, toxic securities, mortgage-backed securities, toxic paper that the major money center banks had gotten into trouble buying. And so the Fed printed up a bunch of money to reliquify the banks, to take those toxic, worthless mortgage securities off the balance sheet of the banks and put them onto the balance sheet of the American people, basically on the balance sheet of the U.S. dollar. So we have seen the most incredible eruption of monetary printing in modern history during the reign of Ben Bernanke. And now as he goes out the door, he says, oh, but don't worry, situation normal, everything out of control. And beginning next month, instead of printing a little over $1 trillion a year, we're only going to print $900 billion a year. Hello? And so here's the way I look at it. If you project where we will be this time next year, December of 2014, the monetary base, because of this brave decision that they've made to taper this week, the monetary base of the United States at the end of this time next year, at the end of 2014, instead of being $5 trillion, will only be $4.9 trillion. What a brave move they have made. Clearly, Scott, the trajectory of money printing remains alarmingly steep. It remains virtually the same. And why shouldn't it? Because, frankly, we haven't had to pay much of a price for it so far.
Well,
so far.
Now, it seems like, if I remember right, back in, say, late summer, or really, I guess, all through the summer, I'm not sure exactly when it started. But anyway, summer, certainly sometime in the summer of 2008, I remember reading over at LouRockwell.com about how, they're deflating. They're beginning to raise the overnight rates and all that. They've gotten spooked. They're afraid that they've built the bubble up too much, and so now they're trying to let the air out. But you know what always happens, and then there's the Rothbard quote about how you can't let the air out slow. It always pops, and I think that's from America's Great Depression. But anyway, so then that was what happened. Just at the end of September, the bubble popped, and it seemed like, it seems like Bernanke's learned that lesson, sort of. Again, shades, somehow this keeps coming up on the show, Lyndon Johnson saying, well, I'm not going to be the first president to lose a war, so I'm just going to make Nixon lose it years from now. And just who cares about all the people who die between now and then? I think Bernanke's learned the lesson that's the last time he tries to scale back anything very much anyway. He's got to keep the pedal to the metal at least until he can pass it off onto the next schmuck, where he was Greenspan's schmuck who had to take the hit for the giant Greenspan bubble. Or the second giant Greenspan bubble, he's going to make this Yellen or whoever's after her take the hit for him, huh?
Yeah, I think he, you know, as a matter of fact, it's probably pretty shrewd of him to get out now. I'm, you know, fairly certain he was shown the door. Effectively, it was let known that he wasn't going to be reappointed, and it was all done very gracefully. But I think he's got, you know, I wouldn't want to be chairman of the Fed with what they've got coming. And so they put the utterly clueless Janet Yellen in there. And, you know, she's been a factotum of big government, big fiat money, big money printing, big quantitative easing, big Keynesian nonsense all of her professional life. So I said, fine, let her take the hit.
Well, although, I mean, I don't know. Can they just keep inflating and inflating? I mean, it seemed like in the last giant bubble, it didn't really turn around until Bernanke got spooked and made it turn around. Like, if he had just kept inflating, would we still be in the housing bubble from then? If he had not slowed it back?
I can't tell you exactly, but, you know, the market's always bigger than the central bank. I mean, nobody's bigger than the market, and you know, at some point, the market says enough is enough, and, you know, not everybody wakes up at the same time, and not everybody heads for the exit at the same time, but people get spooked, and, you know, I mean, just as a symptom of what we are describing, you know, the Fed, you know, issued pronouncements with their quantitative easing tapering announcement the other day. They also said that, you know, they're going to make sure that interest rates don't rise. As long as inflation is low, they're going to make sure that interest rates don't rise. How exactly how exactly are they going to do it? The only way they've been able to do it is by buying bonds and screwing up the yield curve. But if they say that they're not going to buy any bonds, but they're going to keep interest rates low, they've got a real problem because the market says otherwise. You know, interest rates are probably a point above where they were last year. And, you know, mortgage rates are coming up and, you know, impacting the housing market already. Ultimately, the market is in charge of where interest rates are. And ultimately, lenders, creditors, are in charge of, you know, how much money they will lend the United States government. So when the government goes out to borrow money, the Fed says, oh, we have been the 800-pound gorilla in these Treasury auctions. We've been taking virtually everything. Scott, they've taken everything. I mean, last year, the fiscal year that ended last year, the Fed bought, I guess, just off the top of my head, over 100% of the deficit. So the Fed, during the course of fiscal year 2013 that ended in September, the deficit came in at, I don't know what it was, it was $690 billion or somewhere in there. The Fed bought that much, printed that much money, created that much money out of thin air, and another probably 30, 40, 50, 60 billion on top of it. So the Fed is basically the big buyer, the number one holder of U.S. Treasury debt, period, end of story. Now the Fed says, well, we're not going to have as big a presence in these auctions, you know, and the market's going to have to come in and fill in for us because the government's still going to be having a rollover debt, you know, this portfolio of government bonds that, you know, some of it matures, and, you know, when it matures, it has to be rolled over. Nobody ever thinks the government debt's going to be paid back by any other expediency other than selling another bond tomorrow, so they've got to have people at the auction tomorrow to buy the new bonds, to buy the reissuances and stuff. So, you know, ultimately this is a process that the market is in charge of, and the market, you know, has been more or less happy to buy this debt. But, you know, China has said, look, I'll tell you a story. I'll just tell you one story about how clueless these people are. It was a little over a year ago, and Barack Obama was on David Letterman's show during the presidential campaign. And David Letterman said, well, tell me, how big is the national debt? And Barack Obama, the president of the United States, said, well, I don't know precisely. And he started fumbling and so on. So Letterman tried to help him out. And he said, well, is it $10 trillion? And the president couldn't answer. And so here's the important thing to remember about this. And it's not just Democrats. I could tell you stories about Republicans and Republican presidential nominees that are utterly as clueless. But this is the single most important metric of the solvency of the United States is, you know, how much debt do we have? You know, it has to be paid back. People have to be taxed for it. How much debt do we have? And the president of the United States doesn't know. Now, he assumes a posture in these debates about whether we have too much or too little debt, can borrow more, should we raise the debt ceiling, but he doesn't know how much the debt is. And so Letterman said, well, is it $10 trillion? Well, for the record, it was $10 trillion when Obama was first elected, but at the time of the campaign last year, it was over $16 trillion, having grown by $6 trillion during Obama's watch, and he had no idea how much the debt was, so he pivoted. You know, Obama's always pivoting. He's pivoting from the Middle East to the Senkakus to get us in a war down there. Well, he pivoted on the question of how much the debt is, and he came back with that old liberal refrain that he learned at, I don't know, Columbia or Harvard or wherever he went to school and learned from his liberal professors. He said, well, the thing to know about, he deflected the question because he didn't know how much it was. He said, well, the thing that you have to know about the national debt is we owe it to ourselves.
Yep.
Of course, we never did. You know, it was always owed to people who are called bondholders and people who had paid into Social Security on the bogus representation that they were, you know, that there was a, quote, trust fund, their words, not mine. But in any event, it shows you how clueless he is because we no longer owe it to ourselves. We owe a third of it to foreigners, $2.5 trillion, almost $2.5 trillion just to China and Japan. So the people that are, you know, the fiscal authorities, Republicans and Democrats alike, are utterly clueless about the nature of our problem. And frankly, you know, Yellen and Bernanke and Greenspan and the rest of them are utterly clueless as well. I mean, you remember that Bernanke told us in 2005 subprime mortgage market was contained. In 2005, it was just getting going. Alan Greenspan said, now this is how insular they are in their thought. Alan Greenspan said, well, nobody saw the housing bubble coming. And I'm here to tell you, Scott, since we have a lot of mutual friends.
Hey, I know Robert Blumen. You can't push that one over on me.
There is nobody I know with a rudimentary understanding of Austrian economics that missed it. But they are so insulated. They are so solipsistic in their little world of Keynesian magical monetary theory that they think nobody saw the mortgage bubble coming. So
hey, I was good on the housing bubble back in 1999, 2000, when it was still the dot-com bubble. And there's only one explanation for that, of course, is I was listening to Ron Paul.
Yeah, sure.
And he was saying, oh, yeah, no, look, housing is, land is probably a better bet than a dot-com bubble stock. But then again, there's a big bubble in housing, too,
Well, when the housing bubble popped, did the governing classes turn to anybody who had seen it coming? Did they turn to Ron Paul and said, oh, gee, on the House floor, he described exactly how this would unfold, and it did. We ought to ask him
what to do
about it.
Hey, wait, now let me ask you this, because you talk about how interest rates have got to go up at some point. There's nothing that they can do to hold them back eventually. But then also you're talking about the national debt now at, $17 trillion, et cetera, like that. And so if I remember right, back the last time the Federal Reserve tried to contain out-of-control inflation by raising the interest rates deliberately, I guess you could say the same thing for allowing them to rise very high. What effect that has on the interest payments that the government has to make. And the I heard, isn't it like almost $1 trillion a year or three-quarters of dollars a year just to pay the interest payments on the national debt? And so then if the interest rates go up that much more, then that means they could break the entire budget just paying interest payments on the national debt, never mind any of their empire building or socialism or any of that.
Sure. I mean, the prevailing rates are subnormal. If you just go back to, normalize the rates over the last 12 years or so, if you just normalize it, means interest rates roughly 3 points higher or so. I mean, you add 3 points to the cost of carrying the national debt, that adds $500 billion in interest every year to the debt. So, I mean, nobody can tell you exactly step by step how this one will unfold. They can't tell you, which black swan will appear. I could take you back to other calamities and the burst into the bubbles. Russia defaults on its bonds and it throws long-term capital management upside down. Or somebody shoots an archduke someplace.
These things happen.
And it's never where people are looking. Everybody looks at, Greece or Spain, and then something happens in some place like Cyprus. Everybody's looking at Iran for a war, or they're looking at Syria, and then, an incident takes place, and then Senkakus or something. So it's never where everybody's looking, and it's never expected. Nobody ever says, this is going to be the trigger event when the Archduke gets shot. But it's always something like that. But, I'm at great pains to try to tell people that it's not the triggering event. The bubble won't burst because a black swan appeared on the scene sometime in 2014. The bubble will burst because it's a bubble. That's why the bubble burst, not because, some foreign country has an economic calamity and it ricochets throughout the world. You could call that the triggering event, but the bubble burst because it was a bubble.
All right, so now when they say that there are gains in the housing market and gains in the stock market, all that is just hot air?
No, I mean, it's true. I mean, where are the gains? All of this money, we're talking about all this money printing, all this quantitative easing, where's the money going? I mean, somebody's getting the money. Wall Street's getting the money. It's being stovepiped the direction of Wall Street and the influential money center banks. I mean, it's been stovepiped in the direction of the mortgage market. I mean, half the money is going to mortgage-backed securities and Fannie and Freddie. They're buying their bonds. And, so automobile sales, of course, they move heaven and earth, and they buy $85 billion a month to force interest rates down. So, of course, automobile sales have been great. and or better. You know, we had a little boomlet in housing because, you know, they were able to force interest rates down. And, of course, Wall Street's doing great. But I could tell you there is an exact perfect overlay. If you watched, you know, the rise since the recession hit in the Standard & Poor 500 and the rise in the monetary base since the recession hit, they are virtually an exact corollary. I mean, you've never seen an overlay that tracks as well as this. They both go up at the same rate of ascent, and it's only because, you know, the creation of this money has been, you know, the wind beneath the wings of the stock market. So, yeah, the stock market's very, very high. All of these things come at the expense of somebody else. You know, there are two sides to every ledger sheet, to every balance sheet. And so all of these things are at the cost to savers. You know, savers, little old ladies in retirement that should be saving money, you know, they're forced into taking risk, higher risk than they should, you know, buying bonds in places or from people that you wouldn't think retired people would, to try to get a decent rate of return, because the Fed has manipulated interest rates down to serve one factor of the economy rather than another one. So it's a war. It's been a war on savers. It's been a war on, you know, the elderly and people that need to, you know, are on fixed incomes and so on and so forth. So, I mean, the Fed, nothing the Fed ever does is market neutral. You know, if they decide to force interest rates low, they hurt people on the other side of that equation. If they decide to raise interest rates, then they hurt other people. Rather than letting the prevailing interest rates that signal reality about the availability of money and credit in the marketplace, interest rates that show you, that convey information about what's really going on, they manipulate them, and they manipulate them down to help one faction or up to help another faction, and all it does is create distortion and malinvestment in the economy. It favors one class of Americans as against another class of Americans, and as a consequence, it is not a social lubricant by any means. It is social dynamite, and these are some of the pressures that are beginning to build in the fabric of American life.
Yeah, well, and of course, they're always describing it as on behalf of the powerless. And of course, you know, just on the basic level, right, about, you know, ultimately regular folk from farmers to office workers or anybody else who's basically a creditor, they all want inflation, especially like on their house note, right? Borrow in dollars and pay back in dimes. By the time you're done paying off what your house costs 30 years later, it's not that much anymore because all the, you know, the contract price is stuck in olden days by then. But it ignores all the other effects of the pain of inflation on people like that, such as, for example, they can never even dream of saving up and buying a house. They'd have to go ahead and get a giant debt, a 30-year debt, in order to even have one in the first place. And
well, your
never
comment,
even consider otherwise.
Your comment reminds me of the old line that, you know, the federal government must love poor people because they're creating so many of them. But, you know, the wealth divide is growing like crazy in the United States. I mean, I used to keep at my fingertips, you know, great examples of it, Pew studies and Milken Institute studies and these studies and those studies, you know, about, you know, how the wealth divide is growing and income disparity in America and asset disparity and so on. I don't even do it anymore because everybody gets it. Everybody knows that the Fed has... Well, they don't know the Fed. They know that the wealthy are getting a lot wealthier, and, you know, the morons think it's because of capitalism. Well, I don't know. I've been looking everywhere, high and low, under the bed. I don't see any capitalism in this country. I see manipulation of markets by the Fed. I see them stovepiping money to their favorites. I see them moving monetary and fiscal policy to help the wealthy. So, you know, which should be no surprise. I mean, we're coming up Monday on the 100th anniversary of the Federal Reserve, created by the banking cartel to serve their interests to begin with, and 100 years later, that's exactly what they're doing. Who should be surprised? But, you know, the morons blame it on, you know, capitalism. They think capitalism is that caricature in Monopoly, you know, the Monopoly man money with the silk hat and the spats and the cane and stuff like that, when in fact we don't really have capitalism at all. We have crony corporatism in America, with the Fed doing everything to enrich them And of course, they are enriched at somebody else's. They're not enriched because they're creating great new products and services for Americans. There are people that have done that. There are people at Apple and corporations that, you know, create real things that are creating real wealth for the American people and improving life. No, Wall Street's not doing that. Wall Street's getting rich because it's bleeding off the American people, thanks to its gopher, thanks to its hay boy, thanks to its towel boy in Washington in the Mariner Eccles building.
In the that's what they call the central bank tower there.
That's the marble palatial hall where, you know, the headquarters of the private pilots and the, you know, private chefs and the you know, the limousine drivers that ferry the muckety mucks about as they go about the business of, you know, draining the people's wealth and funneling it in the direction of the banks.
My dad has this thing on his desk. It says, "Yeah, if you're so smart, why ain't you rich?" And clearly that applies to me. And the thing of it is, you know, of course, because I always insist how smart I am all the time. No, but the point being that I really did read The Creature from Jekyll Island back in, I think, 1996 or something like that. And that's all good, sound, Misesian gold economics there. And so I understood about the business cycle back then. I knew better during the whole dot-com thing. And like I was saying, all during the housing thing. I was warning my friends in 2005 and 6, don't buy a house now, wait till the giant bubble crashes, but before the interest rates go up, and then lock in a low rate at a depressed price, you know, kind of thing. So that's the proof that I know about this stuff, and yet I never participate in it, and I never make any money off of it. And for the worst example, the one that's really getting at me now, is Bitcoins. I knew about Bitcoins because I'm a libertarian and a radio show host. People are telling me about these things the day after they were invented or something. But I never had anything to do with that. I don't ever have any money. And if I did, I wouldn't spend them investing in Bitcoins or anything. But meanwhile, I could have turned $1,000 into $50 million in the last couple of years. Something like that. If I had just decided to participate in playing the game that all of these zillionaires are playing at my expense all day anyway, right? What's wrong with that? Shouldn't I be in on one or the other of these things?
Well, I'll tell you, Scott, this is a deep philosophical question that such as we have never encountered before in our conversations, but I've known you for a long time. I've spent a lifetime in radio and know a lot of radio people, and you are among the very, very smartest. And I think that you performed a wonderful service, and I think you've created good karma for yourself. So, you know, all the transitory things that are very, very nice. I mean, look, we all like to have, you know, we all like to be wealthy and prosperous. I advocate for it every day of my life. But, you know, it's ultimately on the very last day, it probably matters a lot more what you have done to awaken the people about the needless slaughter of human beings around the globe and the policies of the people that have led us to this pass, and to try to stop the bloodshed to the extent that you can. And I think you have been very, very, you're very capable, and you've been very effective. And if you would want to switch your focus from doing that you have done so well these many years, and turn your focus to, you know, making money on opportunities that come around, like Bitcoin, and it's like the city bus. There's always a new opportunity every day. If you miss one, it's not a problem. Next bus is coming along. If you wanted to change your life and change your focus to that, I think the loss would be all of ours.
Yeah. Well, maybe I'd change my focus just a little bit. I saw a guy on my Facebook feed said he got 40 emails from people saying, "Holy, I'm a millionaire." And I thought, yeah, you know, I could have been listening to that guy. He was just, you know, one of these evangelical Bitcoiners over the last couple of years, and sure was feeling good the last couple of weeks. Anyway, I don't know how he is today, but anyway. All right, we're over time. Thank you very much for your time. I like talking with you, Charles.
Always great to speak with you, Scott. Thank you so much.
All right, everybody, that is the great Charles Goyette. CharlesGoyette.com is his website, and check out his books. They're really great. I mean, brilliant stuff. These are the kind of books that you give to people that you love for Christmas. The Dollar Meltdown and Red, Blue, and Broke All Over. Really, I mean it. 4-star stuff.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richman, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richman at fff.org/subscribe. And tell you heard it here.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council of the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com.
Hey, y'all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.